been a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
That's really good for me. What the heck that could be. Okay, well, let's see what's happening anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they just the exact same spot the whole time. They're outdoors, I can say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Mark Reeser, are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc. UFOs over New York,
and I am too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to edition 448 of Strange Days Indeed, recorded over the first 2 weeks of September 2007. This time, our editorial contributor Dave Ferlot, Austin, Texas researcher and broadcaster, the open-minded Stephen Miles Lewis, or as he likes to be known, Smiles Lewis, and famed researcher, author, Jerome Clark. And more clippage, too, in this program, the voices of recently forthcoming first and second generation Roswell witnesses, recorded and made available online by the Sci-Fi Channel in the United States. There's much to hear in this edition, so let's press on.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Ferlot.
I've been reading reports of UFO sightings for a long time now, and it seems that many of the sightings have been explained as nothing more than simply a weather balloon, including even some of the reports by very notable witnesses like pilots. And what about the poor, maligned weather balloon? What makes it a suitable suspect for UFO sightings? Weather balloons, when launched, are not that large. But as they enter the upper atmosphere, they expand into thinner air, and because they are made of a very strong rubber, they change shape on a continual basis, including even flattening down to look saucer shape at times. The wind currents in the upper atmosphere sometimes are moving at hundreds of kilometers an hour, and those currents sweep a balloon along at those speeds, and as they change, they can move the balloon in varying directions. There are many UFO reports that have been tagged with the infamous weather balloon explanation, including one of the most famous, the incident near Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And with the various characteristics that occur with weather balloons, as I have explained, it's easy to forgive somebody when they make an erroneous report of a UFO that was, well, really nothing more than an inflatable hunk of rubber. The simple explanation of it was nothing more than a weather balloon is very attractive to various agencies throughout the world. It's simple, fast, case closed. Everyone, go back to doing what you were doing. Why? Because it's easy. There are thousands of weather balloons released every single day, and they bounce all over the place. So one can be seen anywhere, perhaps thousands of miles away from where it was released. So the CIA, the Air Force, various airline companies, the FAA, and many others offer that up as an excuse. Actually, there's a rumor that some of them have a rubber stamp made up, and it says it was a weather balloon to affix to some of the UFO reports. But, yeah, you knew there was a but coming, didn't you? When viewed in flight, the weather balloon could easily be misidentified and reported as some kind of UFO, particularly by someone that is not familiar with aerial phenomena. But there's the rub. When pilots who have 12, 15, 20 years or more experience at their job make a report of the sighting of a UFO, you can be reasonably certain that in the course of their career, they have probably seen more than just one weather balloon. And more than likely, they're probably pretty knowledgeable of all of the flight characteristics of such a thing. When somebody who is not present can actually sit comfortably at his or her desk and then tell the pilot that what he or she saw was just a weather balloon, it's like a slap in the face. And that slap in the face is not limited to just the pilot. It goes right along to the co-pilot, the flight engineer, the flight attendants, passengers, and even down to you and me, dear listener, because the person that issues that proclamation of the sighting being a weather balloon has absolutely no proof to validate their claim. And that is, of course, until you get to one of the more famous "it was a weather balloon" story, with the sighting reports made near Roswell, New Mexico. The Army Air Force held a press conference to show us the proof that it was nothing more than a weather balloon. However, that didn't mean they didn't slap us in the face again. This time, they didn't insult the person who reported the UFO, or as it was called at the time, a flying saucer. They insulted the intelligence of the man they charged with investigating it. And once again, they insulted us too. They slapped all of us in the face because they do not give us credit to have enough intelligence to see through the ruse, the cover-up. Instead of telling us the truth, they would prefer to allow us to think, well, we're actually stupid enough to believe that people who handle the debris are not capable of being able to identify common rubber, tin foil, balsa wood, and paper. No. I'm not saying that every UFO sighting that has been pegged as a simple weather balloon is a cover-up and a lie. Because, yeah, there are many UFO sightings that simply are common things that people have never seen before. But I can quite comfortably say that some of the UFO weather balloon stories are just that, lies, cover-ups, and an insulting belief that just because it comes from some government or military agency, we are going to accept it like mindless sheep. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
And a damn fine take it was, too. I have to wonder, sitting listening to you, you talked about commercial and military aircraft, most of which are jet-propelled.
Exactly. These guys are up there zooming along at sometimes two and three times the speed of sound. And all of a sudden, they've got something that's keeping up with them. Now, I know the air currents up there are fast, but they're not that fast.
One has to wonder, you know about the damage that a seagull or a bird on a runway as a commercial airliner is taking off that gets sucked into the air intake.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonder that there aren't more accidents with weather balloons when you consider the number that are released over North America every day.
Because there's literally thousands. Every single day, thousands of these things go up. And once they're released, you can't just turn around and go, okay, well, I would like you to go a little bit to the west. No. Whatever happens up there is where it's going to go. Thousands, literally thousands of miles. They drift all over the place. We have no choice as to where they go, and they do definitely drift into the flight paths of commercial airliners and sometimes restricted military airspace.
There's no control over where they go.
No.
They're destined to follow the wind.
And again, the guys that are up there that have been flying for 15 and 20 years, they've got to have seen more than just one weather balloon. So when they make a UFO report and they turn around and somebody says, oh no, what you saw was a weather balloon. If I was the pilot and the guy was standing in front of me saying, I'm sorry, what you saw was a weather balloon, I'd deck him. You know, don't insult my intelligence like that, please.
Apparently Marcel looked very sheepish, Jesse Marcel, Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer, when he had to show James Bond Johnson, who was the photographer, who took those famous pictures. He didn't look totally thrilled.
No, of course not, because he was following orders. Yeah, he was following orders and supporting a lie. There is no question whatsoever now that it was a lie, because they finally came out and said so. They said that they brought in stuff to make it look like this is what we picked up. If you read into the report, they talk about the fact that, no, this was a Mogul balloon, but it was stated that remnants of a weather balloon were brought in for the photograph. This was not what he brought back.
Actually, interesting, I'm going to be playing some clips from interviews that Sci-Fi Channel did with several of the first-hand and second-hand witnesses at Roswell.
That will be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I posted to the UFO updates list a link to the Sci-Fi Channel in the last few days. If the listeners would like to go and see those witnesses that I will be playing clips from in a little while, they can do that. Links are in the program listing, as I'm sure many astute listeners have already noticed at the program page. Fascinating stuff. And Jerry Clark, who is on a little later, alluded to the Roswell mystery, too, as he calls it.
Yes, most definitely it is a mystery.
That just doesn't want to go away.
It simply can't, because, again, anybody with a functioning brain has got to realize that there is no way somebody could turn around and go, oh, gee, I've got some rubber, I've got some balsa wood, I've got... Yeah, this could be a flying saucer.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to tell me you can't identify rubber, balsa wood, paper, and tinfoil? No, I don't buy it.
And I wonder how many times we're going to go over this ground together.
Oh, many, many times, till we finally find out what the heck it was.
Or we draw our last breath.
Yes. It could be a combination of both.
Die of heart failure when you discover the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Good timing. Well, as always, Dave, it's a pleasure having you on.
And it's a pleasure being on.
An invaluable service.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, mind snappers.
Fun stuff.
We'll talk to you next time, Dave Verlot.
For sure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Things that make you go,
My name is Jack Drawbridge, and I was assigned to Roswell in April of 1947. I was further assigned into intelligence with Jesse Marcel, who was the head of intelligence, a major. I was the first lieutenant pilot. On this particular evening, we're having bridge at Major Marcel's home. He was there in a basket. My wife was there. All of intelligence was there playing bridge, except Jesse. He was out with a pickup gathering this junk in the debris field. Okay? So when he came in, it was fairly late, I believe. And we broke up the bridge game then to go out and see what Jesse had brought in. And it was of great interest. It was aluminum in appearance. There were fragments of aircraft scanner, whatever the thing was, and also some girders with pictures of hieroglyphic-like things on it. I took them to be owls, but who knows? Anyhow, it was interesting. I did get to handle the material. And the material had some peculiar properties. For instance, it looked like Hershey bar wrappings. But you squeeze it up in your hand as hard as you could, let go, and it returned to the original shape instantly. Then the next day, Jesse brought some of the stuff into the intelligence office. So we looked at it and played with it a while, and then everybody went back to work. Later that day, boom. Nobody knows anything. You just shut up. Nothing happened, etc. And when you're in the service, you do what they say to you. Major Marcel was called up to Fort Worth to show the press what he found. Well, what he had to show the press was really a weather balloon. This stuff was not a weather balloon, what he brought back. So he was forced to lie to the press, we say. I don't think he was too happy about it, but you do what you're told again. You're in the service. You followed orders. They were afraid of the American public panicking with this knowledge. I don't think that would have happened, but the word came down from up above, and you do what it says.
I heard some of you got your families living in cages, tall and cold. Some just stay there and dust away past the age of old. Is this true? Please let me talk to you.
The name Stephen Miles Lewis I have recognized for a very long time. He's been a subscriber to the UFO updates list. But it's only recently that we've actually talked in person. Stephen has been involved in all kinds of UFO-related projects down there in Austin, Texas, the capital of Tejas. And he joins us on the phone from down there in Austin, Texas. Hello, Stephen Miles Lewis.
Hi, Errol. It's Miles. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Miles, it's good to have you on. You have been doing quite interesting things over the years. How did you get involved in the subject that we euphemistically call ufology?
Well, I guess just growing up with a heavy dose of science fiction being poured into my head via the mainstream media, film, television, radio, watching movies like Star Wars and TV shows like reruns of Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica, and growing up on science with shows like Cosmos on PBS, got me thinking about the nature of the universe and the scientific approach to trying to understand it, and along the way stumbling upon the wild and weird areas of human consciousness as it tries to grapple with the mysteries of the unknown, like unidentified flitting about the skies. I basically, you know, saw Hangar 18 as a youth and grew up with the idea, the meme of crash saucers, pickled aliens, and government cover-ups being a part of my belief system. At least it was a part of my belief system for quite some time until I started reading more about the subject area of UFOs and finding out that there were a lot of other hypotheses out there by different researchers and writers that were looking to explain this strange phenomena.
And obviously you've gone way beyond Carl, billions and billions, Sagan, who oddly enough started out almost being a believer, according to an article that he wrote for Stars and Stripes when he was a young Turk, and became an arch skeptic.
Yeah, I think skepticism is a good thing. It keeps the people who have a belief system attached to these areas of investigation in check. But yeah, I think I definitely went beyond Carl Sagan in looking into these things, I hope a little more objectively, but also spending much more of my time than I can imagine him having actually spent on it. I haven't been involved in that many direct investigations, but from the very beginning of my childhood, I was reading books about these subject areas, and then basically shortly after graduating from high school, getting involved in the local Mutual UFO Network chapter, the Austin MUFON chapter, that was headed then by Ellen and Monty Stewart, and continuing to amass a book collection on the subject, and reading as much as I could, and talking to all sides of the ufological gamut of believers, skeptics, and debunkers, and trying to weed wheat from chaff and find out what's really going on. In the early days here with the Austin MUFON group, there was a lot of interaction with Ray Stanford and his Project Starlight International investigations out in North East Austin, I think, or Northwest Austin, where he had advanced research facility using lasers, radar, magnetometers, and other technological gadgetry to try and scientifically document the UFO phenomena. And the early Austin MUFON scene came into its own under Ellen and Monty's direction and got several mini conferences going here that I was lucky enough to videotape. So in my budding ufological days, I was privileged to videotape various people claiming alien abduction here. That we had a first little mini conference featured, of course, Walt Andrus, the then head of MUFON, giving a lecture and giving us a prequel to the famous Bud Hopkins case that's associated with the multiple witnesses from the Brooklyn Bridge and various points around Long Island. And Andrus intrigued me by his brief description of this upcoming case that was going to be talked about soon in public, but wasn't at that conference. At that conference, we were featuring George and Shirley Coyne, the American abductees that were making the rounds those days, talking about the experiences that they were having and the apparent harassment by seeming military personnel and helicopters, as well as the then budding crop circle phenomena. The researchers, Busty Taylor and I think Richard Andrews, lectured about strange phenomena associated with crop circles that were emerging over in England at the time. And one of my first activities for Austin MUFON, there was a little news story down in Alvin, Texas, which is just outside of Houston, about some footage that was shot by some locals that featured a glowing orange light in the distance that was videotaped. And when they zoomed in on the object, it seemed to have a shape that was actually reminiscent of other shapes that were being displayed on shows like Hard Copy and other tabloid journalism shows. And my job was to secure a copy of that tape for Austin MUFON, which I did. And one of the more active skeptics among Austin MUFON was a fairly famous fellow named Gerald Ron Johnson, who it later was revealed to me was an assistant to Hal Putoff of Zero Point Energy and Remote Viewing fame. And Ron showed us evidence of how the shape of the light was in fact just an optical effect of the video camera. It was basically a lot of cameras of a certain type, if you zoom in on a point of light at night, it takes on a certain shape that's reminiscent of a disc with a notch taken out of it and a hole in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that shape come up over and over again in UFO footage because it's an artifact of the cameras, not an actual indication of the shape of the craft. So that was kind of interesting, seeing, you know, here's this scientific skeptical guy who I really respected, you know, saying, well, this is interesting, you know, it still may be a UFO, whatever that is, but the shape that's being attributed to it is just an optical effect. So that kind of informed my early approach to UFOs, though at the same time I was delving into much more wilder ideas about UFOs than Ron Johnson was particularly interested in investigating, and of course that would be areas like consciousness exploration, Terrence McKenna, and his ideas about the nature of psychedelics and their possible import in examining the UFO phenomena.
Well, both you and Alfred Lemberg have raised his name, and I attended a couple of Terrence McKenna's lectures here in Toronto, too.
Oh, wow.
Fascinating man. And it's interesting to hear you say that you've moved beyond just looking at UFOs the way most of the field does, because it seems to me that most of the field is very blinkered in their approach to their research.
Well, something about my personality makes me interested in looking at everything from a multidisciplinary perspective. If I want to know about something that I'm passionate about, I want to know about all aspects of it. I want to know the political aspect. I want to know the social aspect. I want to know the psychic aspects, the emotional aspects. And boy, UFOs sure can generate political, emotional, and social reactions in individuals and the mass of society at large,
mm-hmm.
in very interesting and important ways. And researchers like Jacques Vallée really made me look at the phenomena from various different perspectives. And one of his areas that he explored was the psychic impact of these phenomena on the witnesses and the after effects on various close encounter witnesses that involved change in sleep cycle and physiological effects and changes in their belief systems, and sometimes these inducing of psychic ability. It's not to say that anybody who sees a UFO is going to suddenly become psychic or more psychic than they already were, but I think what he found seemed to bear out in the data that there was often a profound effect upon the witness. And he and other researchers then looked at that and said, well, okay, well, if this is happening on as massive a scale as the UFO phenomena is, then that's going to have a societal effect. And if it's going to have a societal effect, it's quite likely that the powers that be would take at least some interest in that and possibly weaponize it or turn it into something that could be used to their advantage. And while that's a whole can of worms unto itself, that's a lot of the areas that I've ended up looking at the UFO phenomena from, is whatever they are, whatever UFOs are, what's the effect that they're having on society at large? And some people say, oh, there's no effect at all. UFOs have had no impact on society at large at all. And others would say, well, no, they're subtly shifting perception. All you have to do is think about what's the catchy phrase nowadays is tipping point. What's the tipping point for belief in UFOs, belief in an unknown mystery that's cavorting about our skies that confounds our military, or the mainstream myth of they're extraterrestrials and they're here from a dying world and they're mucking about in our genetics, and what percentage of the population believing that could start affecting the way they vote?
mind control.
And that's just it. Anybody who investigates UFOs has to contend with consciousness, perception, memory. What are those things? You know, there's no good definition out there for consciousness. There's very bad, limited understanding of memory, and yet there's people that claim that hypnosis can manipulate memory, and that some people say that there cannot be any trauma-induced amnesia, and yet there seems to be perfectly good evidence of that in shell shock victims and other types of car crashes and traumas. And anybody looking at perception and consciousness and the manipulation of those things comes up against the cover-ups and the exposés involving things like the CIA's MK-Ultra program, mind control. And while there's a lot of speculative, imaginative, sensationalistic conspiracy theories out there, the facts, as best we can suss out, do seem to indicate that humans are very easily manipulated. And there are tried-and-true techniques going back as far as human society sitting around a campfire and getting in their brain and trained by looking into the flickering fires of a campfire, to the simplest things of people listening to the sound of someone's voice becoming hypnotized, or driving along the road and getting that highway hypnosis from looking at the line in the center of the road going by over and over again, or the flickering rate of driving along or biking along a tree-lined avenue that the sun's shining through those trees at just the right flicker rate. A person can be induced into an epileptic seizure. They can have fugue-like, coma-like states induced, apparently. When you start looking at that, and then you look at UFOs, it becomes really interesting to think about, well, okay, if there's some advanced civilization that may or may not be terrestrial that's able to do these things, again, the United States military would probably be interested in that. And I think there's something to be said about looking at a lot of the close encounter cases over the last several decades in terms of non-lethal weaponry, non-lethal technologies. It almost looks like whatever aliens or humans or whatever was going on there was experimenting with new technologies. We've got people now trying to push the Verichip and other implantable devices. And where did we first hear about those? Besides science fiction, we heard about them in close encounter cases and abduction cases. The ability of a being to immobilize a UFO close encounter witness with a flashlight. Well, that's kind of an interesting little technology. And, oh, guess what? There are now supposedly devices that range from acoustic to light-based to electromagnetic-based that can affect the consciousness of individuals or whole crowds. And we're hearing a lot about this now that Homeland Security is on the job.
Yes. The point that you brought up about the change in people, the psychic ability, it's not only a psychic ability, it's in an artistic ability too. Because apparently there have been a lot of people who've had close encounters of the fourth kind who have suddenly become artists or have become amazing musicians. There's this staggering change in their abilities and, to all intents and purposes, documented changes.
Wow. Well, I'm not as familiar with those, but that's an area that I would love to ask Bud Hopkins about. Here's an artist who investigates close encounter cases, or a specific type of close encounter, because often there doesn't seem to necessarily be a UFO involved. These alien abduction, often described as bedroom visitation type encounters that he's investigated. I'd be curious to know is that where that data comes from? Is it Hopkins?
A lot of it is out of the UK. Out of British researchers, and I recall reading about it in the old UFO magazine and older editions of Fortean Times. There were many articles written about the expanding of the consciousness into art.
Well, I think that falls right in line with the idea of the psychic aspect of the person being expanded, that they have a different take on things and different parts of their brain perhaps are suddenly being activated and used that weren't before.
Have you noticed the number of musicians that are involved in this field?
Not recently, but I know that, of course, again, mentioning Britain, there are various famous pop singers and musicians have claimed UFO sightings or close encounters mm-hmm. or have gone so far as to investigate UFOs. I know for a while in the 90s and still into the 2000s, there's been a lot of UFO alien symbolism replete in electronica music and dance culture and mm-hmm. Rave culture.
Yeah, it's amazing if you subscribe to Napster and you go and do a search there for UFO, how many tracks there are there with the name UFO in them. I was actually referring more to people that you know personally, people in the field. There seems to be an over-preponderance, for instance, of drummers.
Oh, I definitely am not very aware of that fact, but that doesn't surprise me.
Remote viewing, I had done an interview with Lynn Buchanan, and I remember it wasn't on the UFO program that I asked, but it was just as the old Mind Shift program that I did, which was everything else, was closing out. And I said, by the way, Lynn, have you or anybody that you know involved in remote viewing, have you looked at or remotely viewed UFOs? Closing moments now, seconds to go, and he says, yes, and you'd be amazed at what we've discovered. Well, good night, Lynn. Thank you. But I had him back, and we had a fair discussion about it on the old broadcast. Interesting stuff, and there's no doubt in my mind that remote viewing works.
Yeah.
And the things that they have found by remote viewing on the moon really ties into a lot of the rumors that you hear that NASA tried to avoid when they were going to the moon.
Remote viewing is something that I've been aware of for a long time. My lifelong interest in UFOs has been paralleled by a lifelong interest in parapsychology, the nature of consciousness and anomalous cognition, lucid dreaming, that sort of thing, precognitive dreaming. From personal experiences and reading tons of books about the subject, I was early on aware of Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ's book Mind Reach that was their publicly available information about the research they were doing at Stanford Research Institute on remote viewing. Of course, at the time, apparently it was quite well known that this was being DOD funded, but I was unaware of that at the time until this all came out in, I guess, around 94, 95. Suddenly it was everywhere. Remote viewing was being talked about on all the mainstream media outlets, and thankfully I was already up to speed on how simple it is, how as technical as the protocols are that were developed by Swan and Puthoff and written into Army manual form by Paul Smith and others. It's a really basic and simple approach to trying to use psychic functioning, and I find it a fascinating area that really, it's almost like meditation, I think. If something as simple as this could just be taught to everybody, we'd probably live in a better world. I think that's a talent that can be developed in people who already have a flair for it, because the data seems to suggest that everybody is psychic to a greater or lesser degree, and the military is, of course, going to look to find those people with a flair for it and then teach them how to use it even better than they already could. And the UFO connection to remote viewing comes up over and over and over and over again. Of course, one of the most wild things I've probably ever read was Ingo Swann's self-published book, Penetration, which, despite the editing job of it, is fascinating reading, and I had the opportunity to ask both Paul Smith and Hal Puthoff point blank, you're friends with this guy, what do you make of his claims in this book? And for those that haven't read it, he claims that half the book is about anomalies related to the moon, and half the book is his story about what happened to him while he was taking part in the SRI remote viewing research in California. And he basically says that while he was doing the research with Hal and others through SRI, that there was some kind of super secret military group or intelligence agency group that was spiriting him away to various underground locations and locations in Alaska and having him remote view targets, and also in the Alaskan incident, witness the apparent manifestation of a strange UFO that proceeds to shoot up the landscape with what appear to be lasers. But in his remote viewing sessions that were often done at what he believed to be underground facilities, he would be tasked with remote viewing parts of the moon and would, as you were alluding to, discover much to amaze any person, and that's entities, alien beings, operating on bases on the moon, and at some point them becoming aware that he was watching them. Now, one of the things that I'm curious about remote viewing is how easy it is to use disinformation and use other remote viewers or people who are skilled in the reverse of it, direct mental influence, to perhaps influence the remote viewer to make them see what they want them to see. I recall in various remote viewing books different tactics that were suggested to confuse possible remote viewers, like possibly putting strangely shaped, cartoony-looking inflatable balloons and missile silos or something to that effect, that if a remote viewer saw that, they wouldn't know whether to trust the remote viewer because they're describing, this, you know, say, a Nike missile or some other type of nuclear missile. But they're also saying, oh, and I'm seeing a big floating head of Mickey Mouse. You know, they might not know what to make of that. It certainly seems to be true with remote viewing that you can not only remote view things that we know are verifiable and real, but as unfortunately some of the less scientific remote viewers have done over and over again, is remote view targets that you can't get any feedback on, which is just pointless. Certainly less than scientific, that you can never verify the reality of the target. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? And there's a famous case where allegedly Ed Dames was remote viewing a target that he was ultimately perceiving as a Russian sneak attack, but the target turned out to be Santa Claus, or so the story goes. So if somebody can remote view a fictional character or a mythical character, I suspect they can remote view an idea, a meme, or as Rupert Sheldrake has coined the phrase, a morphogenetic field or something. In fact, I think this actually tells us a lot about the nature of remote viewing and the nature of universe, with a capital U, that all points and all times are accessible by consciousness if you know how to use it right, but it's best to be able to verify that data that you come back with, otherwise you can go off on wild goose chases.
That's shades of Michio Kaku, isn't it?
Perhaps. I'm somewhat familiar with his ideas.
Yeah, well, me too.
Because of string theory and such, I'm a little at a loss.
What Michio Kaku suggests is that there are what they think at the moment are 11 different dimensions, and consequently, anything is possible.
I know I'm going to sound like a New Age cliche, but I mean, I think that's really what the new physics and bold quotes has been telling us for a long time. I think a lot of New Agers are right that there is a lot in the cutting-edge physics out there, and perhaps in aspects of physics that have been suppressed or forgotten, that really do allow for all the strange phenomena that we're familiar with if you look into UFOs and parapsychology. I mean, this stuff becomes very normal and not paranormal and almost routine or to be expected. One of the more interesting conferences that I was able to attend over the years was in London in 1999, put on by Earthlights researcher Paul Devereaux, called Otherworld, Exploring the Ontological Status of Otherworld Reality, or something to that effect. And the idea was he got together a bunch of different researchers, from psychedelics researchers to UFO researchers to consciousness researchers to a wide spectrum of interesting people, including Jacques Vallée, Stanley Krippner, Alan Worsley, the guy who first communicated to a laboratory person while in a lucid dream, to talk about what is the actual reality status of all these strange experiences that people have, whether it be out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, close encounters, shamanic journeys. How real is real, or how real are these experiences, and are there other ways to go about exploring these quote-unquote realities? And it was just a fascinating time. Unfortunately, Vallée didn't make it, but Stanley Krippner ended up kind of giving Vallée's lecture in his stead. And, of course, that was a warning to all that things like the Internet and virtual reality, we really needed to be prepared for the spin-off religions and cults that were going to come about. And, of course, remember, Vallée is the one who warned us about things like Heaven's Gate before mm-hmm. it was called Heaven's Gate in his 1979 book Messengers of Deception. Of course, there's kind of a weird twist to that fact in that, you know, as seminal as that book is and as important as it is and how much I recommend it to people, it talks about remote viewing. It talks about the idea that the universe is like a cosmic bulletin board where if you put your intention out there for something, the universe, the nature of it is that it will bring you in contact with that information. It will synchronistically drop that book open in front of you that's the one you've been looking for, and, oh, it opened right to the page you needed to see. But it's also ghost-edited by Ira Einhorn, who is, of course, one of the darker chapters in the rise of the New Age, somebody who was networking and doing what people do every day in the Internet age of having mailing lists and sending out information of a wild and cutting-edge nature, and yet something else was amiss because Holly Maddox was his girlfriend for some time, and they kind of were on the outs. She went missing for a period of time, and at some point, allegedly, the neighbors detected a foul odor emanating from his apartment, and when an investigation was mounted and his property was searched, they found her body in a steamer trunk in a closet off of his apartment. It's a really strange case. It could be as simple as he killed her, like the law ultimately said. He's now serving time for that. But I would remind people, it's a very bizarre case. Here's a man who was intimately connected with Andrea Puhrich, who, if you know anything about the UFO field and the New Age field of the 60s and 70s, you know that Puhrich was really at the heart of a lot of strange goings-on involving channeling and the search for psychic drugs and, again, implantable technologies and alleged contact with extraterrestrials. He was the one who promoted Uri Geller, and he and Ira Einhorn were trafficking in data about Tesla and supposed mind-control technologies that could be utilized understanding Tesla's technologies. Speculation has been for some time that Ira was set up or mind-controlled himself into killing her. Who knows? Things happen. I mean, there's a current things going on in the UFO field that involve someone put the darker side of human life with the Bob Shell case. And is the allegation then correct that he was trying to kill somebody, or is it just, as some have said, a travesty of justice? But
Bob Shell, for those who don't know the name, don't recognize the name, was a longtime contributor to the UFO Updates list, a photographer, and he was accused and found guilty of murdering a young model with whom he was having a relationship and sentenced to 32 years. There are all kinds of stories behind that verdict, too, which are slowly coming out. And if you'd like to know more, I suggest that you go to the UFO Updates list and read about it at virtuallystrange.net. Smiles, are you familiar with the Monroe Institute?
Yes.
They've been doing, over the years, some really interesting stuff, which sort of parallels remote viewing, but not so much remote viewing the way we understand it, but more contact with the other side, which has come out of all the work that they were doing with out-of-body experiences.
Well, in fact, in Paul Smith's book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, he talks about how the Monroe Institute was kind of a staging ground for a good part of the training that was going on as part of the military's remote viewing program. And I actually was not aware of this until reading this in his book, that General Spoonbender Stubblebine was really gung-ho on utilizing the Institute as a place for people training and participating in his program of new explorations of the use of consciousness in the military, but particularly in the remote viewing program, to go there and get training. And the thing about astral travel or out-of-body experiences, and again, this kind of goes back to what Devereaux was saying in the introduction to that Otherworld Reality Conference I was mentioning, and that is that out-of-body implies that you're going somewhere. Astral travel implies that you're going somewhere. When people think about remote viewing, they think that they're astral traveling or going out-of-body to go there and observe this. And while that's a quaint Aristotelian way of looking at things, again, getting into these new physics and these new ideas about the nature of reality, is anybody going anywhere? Is anything going anywhere? Or is it just that everything is connected and through some strange aspect of consciousness we're able to slip into that underwiring of the universe and go and get that information? But then there's, as you say, often this contacting of alien others, this contacting with the ancients or spirit guides or some might think angels, demons, ghosts, yeah.
Yeah, beings that have passed.
And those things are even in the abduction report. Carla Turner was one of my favorite abduction researchers, and bless her soul, she was talking about, look, there's a lot more data out there that goes beyond the Hopkins-Jacobs model of extraterrestrials from a dying planet bent on getting our sperm and ova. There are other reports that often involve humans alongside the alleged big-headed aliens, and often in the cases she and others have investigated, there's the appearance of dead loved ones sometimes in these scenarios. And while some might suggest that maybe it's as simple as, well, you know, these other beings are contacting us through this strange realm, that then the ghosts of our dead loved ones could easily appear there, or that somehow the alien intelligence is manipulating our heartstrings by using that as a mask for their appearance for some other purpose. But my general take on things when it comes to UFOs tends towards the idea that what the UFO close encounter is kind of a virtual reality communications channel, and that in these events, people gain access to that realm that is outside of time, outside of space, and can commune with a wide variety of consciousnesses and intelligences that range from their own higher self or their own individual subconscious to perhaps the collective unconscious of the species in a kind of Jungian way, to possibly the collective consciousness of other species on this planet. But at the same time, it could just as easily, and we know from parapsychological data that telepathy and anomalous cognition don't seem to be limited by distance. So even if there are extraterrestrials on the other side of the galaxy, this communications channel might be just the way to bypass getting in a rocket or sending a probe even through a wormhole. You can just hook up through the underwiring of the universe that seems to be accessible through consciousness and have a meeting that seems physically real and in fact sometimes leaves physical evidence in the wake of the event in the form of the Delphos ring or the marks on contactees and abductees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's, as Clark and Hall and others would be quick to say, that's a paranormal theory. You know? I mean, it's somewhat supported by scientific data. I know they'd probably disagree over the validity of some of the parapsychological data that I think support this as a possibility, and it's just a speculative hypothesis, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I think it fits a lot of the data. But then another good percentage of the time I lean towards something like a crypto-terrestrial idea that whatever this phenomena is, it's been here as long as we have. It's been interacting with us as long as we can remember and as long as we've been writing down things on cave walls. And so it'll probably be with us for a lot longer.
It's also worth noting that not only can remote viewers move through space, but they can also move through time back and forth, which I recall Lynn Buchanan telling me. So that, for instance, you were talking about the Mickey Mouse inflatable balloon in a missile silo,
right?
That the remote viewer could go there, see it, and then go back through time and watch them put it in and go, aha, that's there for my sake, to confuse me. So another arrow in the quiver. We've covered a pretty broad spectrum of ufology and around the fringes and the paranormal.
Around the bend.
Yeah. What is it that you see going on around you? Have you managed to glom on to something that makes you want to hang on to that particular section of your discoveries?
Oh, I've not had any close encounters. So it's not personal experience in that way that it informs my ideas. So I have had a lifelong experience with what I would call anomalous cognition, whether it be precognitive dreams or visions, telepathy, or doing my own occasional experiments with remote viewing. Really, I take inspiration from those people who are trying to be as scientific about it as they can. Groups like the Society for Scientific Exploration, SSE. There are many other groups out there, but that's one that really I think is exemplary in terms of having a peer-reviewed journal and a more learned approach to dealing with anomalous phenomena. Locally, as I mentioned, I've been involved with Austin MUFON. For a time, I actually served as the state section director for local counties, Travis and Williamson, for Austin MUFON. And for a time before that, I actually, at the request of the founder of the local abduction support group, which later became kind of a UFO contact, strange experience support group and study group, at the behest of the person who founded that group, I was invited to take over leadership of that group for a time, and I did. So there's been a variety of activities here locally. Austin has a rich history of looking into the strange, and most people in Texas probably think of Austin as being very, very strange. And in fact, one of the catchphrases for Austin is "Keep Austin weird." So much so that the Chamber of Commerce actually took that up as a slogan. In 2001, I was putting on the National UFO Conference here in Austin. It was going to be a three-day, three-night affair with a ton of speakers, movies, and music at what's now become a very famous Austin franchise, which is the Alamo Cinema, Alamo Draft House. It's a series of theaters where you can sit down and eat and drink while you watch the movies. Mm. But they also do big events for world premieres of movies and that sort of thing. And we were going to do the conference there. But, of course, 6 years ago.
As we're recording today, yes.
September 11th, 2001, that Tuesday before the weekend that the conference was supposed to occur, the world changed dramatically forever. And if anything's really informed where I am today, it's been that. I know that for each generation, there's often a defining event. And while I was already well into my adulthood at that point, it had a pretty profound effect on me. And unfortunately, it's taken me away from the study of UFOs as much as I used to in parapsychology. My goal before the conference was always to found a nonprofit that was to be a lending library to make available all the books that I've collected over the years. And I kept putting that off and putting that off. When I accepted the responsibility for doing the 2001 NUFOC conference, I put that off even further. And then once the horrible events of that day 6 years ago happened and the conference didn't, I wasn't sure where to go, and I reconvinced myself that founding the archives would be the way to go. But that got delayed yet again as I was invited to become editor of a upstart newspaper here in Austin called the Austin Paratimes, exploring the paranormal and the parapolitical in the wake of September 11th. And we did that for a time, but for various reasons, I left the editorship of that magazine and decided, you know, I've been distracted long enough. I'm going to focus back on what has been my goal for years, but that I've been distracted repeatedly from, and that's the founding of my own nonprofit. And so in 2003, I founded the Scientific Anomaly Institute, a.k.a. the Anomaly Archives Lending Library, and with my initial collection of just over 1,000 books, founded this lending library and was lucky enough to meet up with a fellow who actually was old friends with Ray Stanford, which ultimately led me to be able to hang out with Ray for a good 8 hours and pick his brains. But around 2003, founded the archives, started doing events, open houses, having people come and be able to check out books, and holding the occasional mini-conference. In 2005, we held the first annual Texas Ghost Lights Conference that featured Rob Riggs, who organized that, and, of course, Nick Redfern and Paul Devereaux. Paul Devereaux came over from England, and a fellow from out of West Texas who's been investigating the Marfa Lights. And the Texas Ghost Lights Conference was basically exploring the bookended phenomena. In East Texas, we've got the Big Thicket, this huge, huge, huge forest that a lot of people think has Bigfoot and other cryptozoological critters out there, including the much happily rediscovered ivory bill woodpecker. We've got strange lights and phenomena over on a Bragg Road, the Ghost Road, and the Big Thicket in East Texas, where the lights are seen and Bigfoot's seen. And then over in West Texas, in the completely opposite type of environment, the deserty environment of West Texas, we've got the Marfa Lights, those strange balls of light that cavort out there that, yes, a lot of them, again, like UFOs, 80 to 90% of what people see are, in fact, car headlights, but there is a 10 or 20% unknown subset of those sightings that seem to be some kind of BOL, ball of light phenomena. So we had that little conference there in 2005. And then most recently I've decided to continue webcasting about strange stuff and took a hobby and started a new professional web radio station called Anomaly Radio. And so for the last year and a half or so, we've been broadcasting through our website, anomalyradio.com, with an ever-expanding lineup of paranormal and parapolitical programming. I do about 3 different web radio shows a week, and I host a variety of live and relayed broadcasts from people who've been in the paranormal field for the last couple of decades, including several of the fellows from The Excluded Middle magazine, which is actually how I came to expand my paradigms about the possibilities replete in strange phenomena. Greg Bishop, who, of course, is most famous now for his book Project Beta, that talks about the Benowitz affair, where Paul Benowitz was basically disinformed by Bill Moore and AFSCME agent Richard Doty to the point where Benowitz nearly lost his mind, which seeded the public's mind for the classic myth that at the beginning of this program I said that I used to believe wholeheartedly, the idea of crashed saucers, pickled aliens, underground bases, government allegiances with aliens to allow human abduction and cattle mutilations and that sort of thing, and all that seems to be bunk. But on Anomaly Radio, we've now got a bunch of great new shows, including Strange Days Indeed.
Thank you for excerpting the program and putting it up there. And I trust that'll yield hundreds, if not thousands, tens of thousands more listeners as a result of your efforts on this program's behalf.
I make no guarantees, but I'm hopeful as well.
Well, I trust that we all end up with staggering numbers of listeners. I want to come back to Ray Stanford again, because
yes.
I first experienced Ray Stanford, I guess, about 25, maybe 30 years ago, in the 70s anyway, late 70s, early 80s. And my first experience of Ray was watching him on a Canadian TV channel up here, channel being the right word, channeling. There he was from Austin, Texas, and it was...
There were two groups that he was involved with here locally at the time that I'm aware of. PSI, Project Starlight International.
That's the one, yes.
And AUM, the Association for the
Understanding
of Man.
Yeah, and I have several of that association's journals in book form here from back in them days. Fascinating. And then Ray Stanford quit doing channeling and got into spending a lot of time, as you said, Project Starlight International and UFOs. And along with that, and in the last few years, he has become a famous dinosaur hunter.
Indeed.
Indeed.
He's had the same amazing luck and ability at photographing UFOs. He's also had amazing luck in making amazing amateur discoveries in the dinosaur bone, dinosaur fossil arena.
Do you think he's psychic?
Well, he says he is, and I
No,
don't...
I'm joking. You know, and I don't think it's incredible luck. It's synchronicity, and it's what he taps into that leads him to those things.
Absolutely. Ray is a fascinating person. Of course, before I met him, I only knew of him through his book, Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry.
Yeah.
Probably my second favorite UFO book title. Second only to Cyberbiological Studies of the Imaginal Component in the UFO Contact Experience. I say that three times fast. But Ray Stanford's book, Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry, there was a copy at my local library, and I remember reading that and being fascinated by it, and then discovering that his group, PSI, Project Starlight International, was based here in Austin. I was just amazed. Of course, later when I became active with the Austin MUFON group, I got to hear all the stories about different local people's interactions with Ray. And as I said, one of the individuals that I came into contact through local nonprofit groups actually is mentioned in Socorro Saucer in the book as somebody who was helping him with some research, and that's Bob McGarry, who has his own nonprofit here involved in human health and consciousness. And he put me in contact with Ray, and I got to hang out with him, and as I said, pick his brains for 8 hours at least, and it was fascinating. And as you say, here's someone who has obvious talent and obvious psychic talent. And that and his tenaciousness, I guess, led him to photograph more UFOs than I think anybody else has. And I mean, way outpacing Billy Meier. And I hesitate to bring up Billy Meier in the same sentence because I honestly don't think there's any possibility that Ray is a hoaxer. I think he's really just been at the right place at the right time because, as you say, he kind of tunes into, for lack of a better term, the wavelength of these things and has managed to get some amazing photographs and film footage.
Yes, and make some amazing archaeological finds. And if anybody deserves a documentary made about his life, Paul Kimball, I know you're listening, it's Ray Stanford.
Absolutely.
And if Paul doesn't do it, then perhaps Mike McDonald or David Cherniak or any of the UFO-related documentary makers.
Ray also should be well-known for his art. He's apparently been recognized many a time for his artistic ability as well. I haven't had the honor of looking at too many of his paintings, but from what I understand, he's very respected in that regard as well. And he's met so many of the early UFO flying saucer personalities from Adamski and on into the 70s.
He grew up at Adamski's knee, as I recall from the interview that I did with him a few years ago.
Ray has always been involved, as far as I know, with the contactee movement early on, and I think there was some controversy created by some of the things that Vallée wrote. I know Ray was apparently not very happy with that. Ray and his twin brother, Rex. Actually, I find an amazing, interesting parallel between Ray and Rex Danford and Terrence and Dennis McKenna in that one of them seems to have tried to go a more hardcore science mainstream direction, while the other, while dealing with science, has been more into the wilder side.
I think it's fascinating that there would be two sets of twins, like the Stanfords and the McKennas, doing what they do, and somehow each set of twins paralleling the lives of the other set of twins. You know, there's a lot of inexplicable stuff going on out there.
Indeed.
AnomalyRadio.com is the website to go and check out. Smiles Lewis, Stephen Miles Lewis, is there with his podcasts, his broadcasts, his narrowcasts. Call them what you will, but they are available there, along with people like Greg Bishop and others. And I encourage you to go there and have a listen and broaden your horizons beyond the scope of this program. As you've heard Smiles say, there is a lot going on out there that doesn't attract a lot of the mainstream UFO researchers, but is nevertheless very germane to what it is that we talk about on this program. Smiles, thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Errol. It's been a pleasure.
And each time I talk to you, it becomes more and more of a pleasure. It's been good. And thank you for all your help over the last couple of months.
Anytime. I'll have to get you on as a guest sometime soon on one of my live shows.
I was so happy to get away from live radio. You know, brain farting in the middle of a program, you know, is live on air, which I do quite frequently. But the nice thing about the podcast is snip, snip, and it's gone. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Savage Dodson. I was a young GI, 22 years old, at Roswell Army Airfield in 1947. My job out there was in technical supply, and that job included taking care of what we called flyaway kits. One day, the base supplier called me and said, "We have some fuel injection pumps for your flyaway kits." And I said, "Okay, I'll come up and pick them up." So I went to base supply in a weapons carrier and picked up 4 fuel injection pumps. When I came back by the supply unit, I told my friend and buddy there that we worked together, I said, "I'm going up to the hangar where the flyaway kits are to put these injection pumps in there." I drove up to this hangar and backed the weapons carrier up to the personnel door and got out. And with my key, I was about to open the door. I noticed there was an individual over here, but I had not paid any attention to who he was or what he was doing. And the guy says, "Hey, Sarge, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going in the building here to put some fuel injection pumps in our flyaway kits." He says, "You can't go in there." Well, I didn't pay a great bit of attention to him. I just kept walking with my key, and I got almost to the door to insert the key. And he says, "I says you can't go in there." Then I looked at him to see who he was. I noticed he had on an MP armband and had a .45 on his hip. I said, "You and who else says I can't go in there before I saw this?" He says, "Me and this," and patted that .45 on his hip. Well, you don't really argue with a person with a .45 on his hip. So I said, "Okay." I turned around, put the key in the pocket, got in the weapons carrier, went back down to the section, and told my friend H.T. White. He said, "I thought you were going to put those injection pumps in the flyaway kit." I said, "I was, but there's some guy up there with a .45 on his hip and won't let me in the building." And we passed it off and thought more of it. 3 days later, base supply called it. We had some more parts up there for flyaway kit. I went up and got that, added the fuel injection pumps that I was there with 3 days earlier, went up there, walked in, no problem. So why did the man keep me out of that building at that particular time? I do not know. I may be wrong, but why else would I be kept out of that building when I was going in on a daily or weekly basis? Anytime we wanted to go.
Lord, save me from this darkest fear. Don't let me.
Listener Richard Selney emailed me last week saying, a suggestion. I would love you to interview on your show a man by the name of Jerome Clark, who has a brain the size of a planet and is truly worth listening to. Although I fear that if you could have had him on, you would have by now, I feel that there's no harm in asking. Richard Selney, and I hope I'm pronouncing your last name properly, Richard. Actually, Richard, Jerome Clark has been on SDI 5 times over the last 9 years, and of course, there's no harm in asking. So, our feature guest this time is Jerome Clark, who has followed the UFO controversy for 5 decades, is an editor of International UFO Reporter, the magazine of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. Jerome is an internationally respected authority on the subject, whose books include the award-winning multi-volume UFO Encyclopedia between 1990 and 1998, the UFO Book, a one-volume paperback abridgment of the Encyclopedia series, Unexplained, Strange Skies, and most recently, Unnatural Phenomena, a guide to the bizarre wonders of North America, which was published in June 2005. The Unidentified and Creatures of the Outer Edge is a one-volume paperback reissue of 2 books Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman wrote, originally published in 1975 and 1978, respectively. And that book came out in January of last year. So, Jerome Clark, welcome back to the program.
Well, good to be here, Errol. It's always fun.
I did a look up on you this morning on the web just to try and catch up a bit on what you've been doing over the last 10 years. Are you familiar with rambles.net?
Oh, yes. Very well.
It says on rambles.net, Jerome Clark is a writer of 16 or 17 published books. He's lost count. Editor and songwriter, songs covered by Emmylou Harris, Tom T. Hall, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Seldom Seen, Albion Band, and others, as well as an occasional television talking head. This I didn't know about you at all. His interest in what is now called roots music, country, folk, and blues, goes back to his childhood in the 1950s, when he didn't know that some people knew Wreck of the Old 97 and Streets of Laredo as something called folk songs. All he knew was that these were songs that sounded like the world should sound. Well, I have to tell you, I have absolutely adored Emmylou Harris from her times with the late Gram Parsons of the Byrds back in them old days. And in fact, I saw Emmylou Harris here a few years ago in Toronto. And in the silence that inevitably follows the applause at the end of a live song, I hollered, "Emmylou, I want to have your baby." And she looked down at me and she said, "Oh, that's so cute." And Albion Band and Albion Dance Band, I have all their music here.
Oh, wow.
And they were a conglomeration or a conglomerate of many British folk musicians.
Right, basically headed by Ashley Hutchings.
Ashley Hutchings, yeah. Right. It's just a great, great sound out of Ashley and his friends.
Yeah, Hutchings, as you know, was one of the founders of Fairport Convention, so
mm-hmm.
been a major figure in English music.
all those years.
Yeah.
And who'd have known that somebody from Minnesota would be into Albion Band? I think it's the first time that that name, Albion Band, or Albion Dance Band, has crossed my screen in a ufological content.
They recorded our song, Don't Let Me Come Home Stranger, and it's on one of their albums. I wrote it with Robin and Linda Williams. It's a song that I wrote many years ago, and I sort of had in mind something between a British ballad and a Carter Family song. And Robin and Linda recorded it, and other people recorded it. Basically, it's more or less a Carter Family song. But the Albion Band recorded it really as if an old British ballad, and it really sounds nice to my ears.
I'm sure I've heard it before, but it hasn't registered. I didn't look at the writer's credits.
Yeah, it's a song that's been recorded by a lot of people. It ended up on an anthology of the best folk songs of the last 40 years, published by the venerable British magazine Folk Roots. It's been a song that a lot of people have done. Emmy Lou actually almost recorded it as well as the one she did record. And I actually saw her singing on television one time.
So which song did she actually record?
Rollin' and Ramblin', The Death of Hank Williams. It's on her brand new dance album. It's also on one of her retrospectives. She does a great version of Rollin' Ramblin', which sounds actually like a Cajun song. She's got the Cajun accordionist Joel Saunier playing on it. It has a terrific sound, and it's also kind of historically interesting because at one time, because of his drinking and general bad behavior, Hank Williams was exiled from the Opry and ended up at the Louisiana Hayride in Shreveport and played there in his last months.
See, you just never know what UFO researchers are into.
Actually, I think one of the really great passions since my young life has really been traditional music and folk music and roots music and country and blues and all that stuff. It consumes a lot of my time. I have about 3,000 CDs of the stuff.
Oh!
Plus a sizable library of books on the subject.
I was a disc jockey for years and have worked for all kinds of radio stations and played all kinds of music. So my music spectrum is pretty damn wide.
Yeah, I know that you have a background. I read an interview with you somewhere. You were talking very interestingly about your background as a DJ in England.
Oh, on the pirate radio stations.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that was Stuart Miller at UFOReview.net.
That's right.
Maybe I blabbed a little too much during the course of that one, too.
That was very, very interesting.
It's amazing what we did as youngsters. And,
oh, yes.
And speaking of which, you did some pretty amazing things yourself as a youngster. And I'm talking about how you got involved in the things that we talk about on this program.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get involved?
Oh, boy. I read a book. That's how so many of us get into trouble.
Yes. Reading.
When I was young and impressionable, this is 1957, I was about 11 years old, I got interested in science fiction, and I joined the science fiction book club, and the introductory offer was like 3 or 4 books for a dollar. And I knew that the first 3 books I wanted, I'm sort of looking at the list for the fourth one. There was a book called Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Edward J. Ruppelt. And I thought, I'd heard of flying saucers, and that was about it. I thought, well, I'll get that one, too. That looks kind of interesting. And I think that was the first book I read of the 4 in the introductory offer, and I was riveted. And then I began to hear about Charles Fort, and through interlibrary loan, I borrowed the omnibus, the books of Charles Fort. And it was all from there that things proceeded. Pretty soon I was reading everything I could get my hands on back in the late 50s. And I think before the 50s were done, I'd read just about every book on UFOs that had been published up till then, from the serious ones to the very silly ones, you know, the contactee books and so on.
But it's all a good grounding in a history of UFOs.
Well, that's one thing I think that the basis there, not only the curiosity about, you know, what does this mean, what is the cause of this phenomenon, but also just the human aspects, the social history. It's always fascinated me how people got together and formed these movements and created these beliefs and so on. It's a great human story as well as, you know, a genuine scientific mystery.
Maybe a potential subject for another Jerry Clark book.
Well, I think that actually was my encyclopedia. there's an enormous amount of social history in the book. In fact, one very prominent and very serious ufologist one time chided me for all the material on contactees that's in that book.
Mm.
But the contactees are very much a part of the social history and the story, and they had a role in shaping popular beliefs about flying saucers. And you can't write a story about a history of the UFO phenomenon without giving the contactees their due, even if you don't believe their stories, which I certainly don't, although I think that many of them were sincere.
David Cherniak, who's a Toronto-based filmmaker, has an upcoming two-hour documentary for the History Channel here, and presumably it will go to the History Channel in the States and elsewhere on the planet, based on the sociological impact of UFOs over the years.
Yeah, David came out to my little town in rural Minnesota to interview me for that show. I don't know if I made the final cut or not. I hope so. It had to have cost him a few nickels to get out here. I don't live close to anything except the South Dakota border.
Where were you when you were a kid and first came across the Ruppelt book?
I was where I am now, in this little town that I live in Minnesota. I left it when I was 17 years old and returned 25 years later after living in various places, including most prominently Chicago, for quite a while.
I was wondering how you made the leap from the Ruppelt book to the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago.
I'd actually met Alan Hynek in 1976 when I was investigating a UFO abduction case in North Dakota. Alan flew up, and we spent time together, and that's how I got to know him. And I moved to Chicago. Well, actually, this was in 75 that I met Alan. It was the next year that I moved down to Chicago. And then I, over time, got involved with the center, and Alan asked me to edit the International UFO Reporter, which is the Center for UFO Studies magazine. And I've been an editor of that ever since.
I actually saw Alan Hynek many years ago here in Toronto when he lectured at Seneca College. I didn't get re-involved for many years after that, but I have very strong recollection of that talk that he gave.
Well, Alan was a wonderful man. He had great charisma as a lecturer and as a public personality. I got to know him as a private personality, and he was a lot of fun. He had a mischievous sense of humor, and he was just hugely entertaining to be around. I have nothing but good memories of him.
A man who, for the sake of those who don't know who Alan Hynek is, and I can't imagine that any listeners to this program would not know who he is, but Alan Hynek started out as a skeptic, as an astronomer.
From 1948, he was tapped as the astronomical consultant to the various Air Force UFO projects. It started out as Project Sign, then became Project Grudge, and then from 1952 onward as Project Blue Book, which closed in 1969. But almost until the end of Blue Book, Alan was the chief scientific consultant. And basically what the Air Force projects did was turn over reports to him to look over to see if they had an astronomical explanation. He was a skeptic, but it was a complex skepticism, and it wasn't like the classic skepticism, the hardcore debunker like Donald Menzel or Philip Klass or somebody like that. He was skeptical in the sense that he didn't think there was anything going on, but he also, over time, had to acknowledge that there were reports that were puzzling, and that many of the explanations advanced to were rather facile, and they didn't really account for what people were seeing. And he, as early as the early 50s, began to insist that the witnesses had to be taken seriously and had to be acknowledged that some of the reports were puzzling. And he kind of went back and forth over time from a soft skepticism to a hard skepticism. But even in his hard skeptical periods, for example, in the late 50s, he still was troubled by some of these reports, which really seemed intriguing to him, but he needed the money that he was getting from the Air Force, which was helping to finance his children's education. And I'm not saying in a sense that he was corrupt, which he certainly wasn't, but all of us have an ability to rationalize things to a certain extent that are necessities in our lives. But fundamentally, this was a really intellectually honest guy. And at last, he finally just, particularly when he met Jacques Vallée, and Vallée, the young astronomical colleague, who kept pressing him on these puzzling reports and said, well, how can you just not pay attention to these? How can you not confront these head on? And eventually, the little kind of distant voice became a louder and louder one. And then Alan courageously, by the mid-1960s, was a full-throated proponent of scientific UFO study and also of the anomalous nature of the phenomenon. Now, he had his critics on both sides. The atmospheric physicist James McDonald was fiercely critical of Alan for taking so long to come to what McDonald thought was an obvious conclusion, that something very puzzling, possibly involving extraterrestrial visitation, was going on. And he was brutally honest with Alan, to the point that the two of them were really unable to work together. But McDonald died in 1971, and Alan continued. And I think that when the history of all of this is written, Alan Hynek's name will loom large as somebody who glimpsed a truth that his colleagues were overwhelmingly refusing to confront.
Undoubtedly. It's amazing how often his name yet comes up.
Yes, but among ufologists, basically, and among skeptics with long memories, but he has really kind of fallen into obscurity as a public figure. In the 1970s, he actually was fairly famous. Of course, his association with Steven Spielberg and Close Encounters of the Third Kind helped that. But even before that, he'd become a public figure of some notice. But he's really largely been forgotten. I don't think that that will forever be the case, because I think that he was right about the UFO phenomenon. History will vindicate him, and he'll get his due.
You also brought up the name Jacques Vallée, who also was associated with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Truffaut played a Vallée-type character in that film.
Right.
What do you make of what has become of Jacques Vallée in the last 10, 15 years?
Oh, boy. How do I talk about that? I certainly have written about Vallée, often quite critically. I respect Jacques Vallée. I want to make that clear at the start. He's a very intelligent guy. He's a creative thinker. He certainly has a good scientific education, which few of us have. There are kind of two Jacques Vallées. There's one who's a pretty good scientific thinker about the UFO phenomenon. And then there's another one who's a kind of mystic. And the mystic Jacques Vallée is the one who kind of loses me. And his sort of mystical ruminations about the phenomenon are not totally dismissible. I think that there are some things that he came upon early that were important. But unfortunately, over time, his speculations kind of devolved into various sorts of intellectual errors, such as conspiracy theory. When I think about Jacques Vallée, I have about 35 conflicting feelings in my head at once, you know. And I think that on the whole, he's been good for the subject. First of all, I admire the first two books he wrote, Anatomy of a Phenomenon and Challenge to Science, which are two books that really take a good, hard, scientific look at the UFO evidence. His third book was really where his thinking begins to move off in rather heretical directions, and that was a book called Passport to Magonia, published in 1969. And in this book, Vallée argues in a sort of elliptical prose. It's a little hard always to figure out exactly what he's saying, but he seems to be suggesting that UFOs are part of a continuum of other sorts of supernatural traditions that have existed throughout history, involving demonology and fairy lore and all sorts of other sorts of exotic beliefs about otherworldly entities. And I think that he's on to something. It's just the conclusions that he reaches seem to me to be broad and overreaching. And that one problem we may have when we think about the UFO phenomenon is right there. We think of it as a phenomenon instead of as phenomena. There may very well be more than one thing going on. And the various things going on, what I call the core phenomenon and the secondary phenomenon, may not even be related. that the relationships are really only on the surface, but they're fundamentally different. I think that there's a fundamental difference between what I call the event phenomenon, which is the phenomenon that you can demonstrate something happened in the world, something is tracked instrumentally, something leaves puzzling traces on the ground that after laboratory analysis are still unexplainable. And on the other hand, you have the experience phenomenon, where people report extraordinary encounters and make outlandish claims which seem experientially real to them, but which are absolutely undocumentable, unprovable in consensus reality, and seem to exist purely on an experience level. In other words, some kind of what you might call a third kingdom between the kingdom of concrete event reality and fantasy, that there's some level of experience that isn't quite either one of those.
Is that a suggestion about interdimensionality?
No, see, that doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
You can throw words like that around, but they don't explain anything. They're just words. What is interdimensionality? It's a speculative concept. All we can say is that it is possible to have vivid experiences of things that do not seem to be conventionally explainable as hallucinations or mental illness, but also that do not exist in event reality. These things are some kind of anomaly of experience, anomaly of consciousness, anomaly of the imagination. And they're real, but they're real solely as experiences that exist only in testimony and memory. But that really you could never prove happened in this world. And these things take on the coloration of cultural expectations about otherworldly encounters. So in other words, they're fundamentally subjective. There may be some kind of independent phenomenon out there that triggers these things, but they're experienced in cultural images and language that the brain can comprehend.
As in the Bible and as in the talk of little people and fairies and the Immaculate Conception, etc., 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 we've been handed down descriptions through the eons that were couched in the knowledge of the people who experienced them at that time.
One thing that's really interesting, and this is what one thing that Jacques Vallée did for me, for which I'll always be grateful, I never really thought about, for example, fairy lore. I knew about it, like everybody else. I never really gave it a thought until I read Vallée's Passport to Pagonia. And Vallée had dug into the folkloric literature of fairy lore, where folklorists and would go out into the field and interview people about their beliefs about fairies. Well, it wasn't hard to understand that people would have supernatural beliefs, but what was more puzzling was that they kept finding people who appeared to be sane and sincere claiming these kinds of experiences as first-hand things that actually happened to them. And so they would tell these just bizarre stories, just very, very strange stories that made no sense in any kind of way that we ordinarily comprehend the world. And so I began to go to the books that Vallée mentions and also to read beyond them, and I've been reading books on supernatural folklore ever since. And you find that no matter how exotic the tradition, there are people who claim first-hand experiences with it. In fact, in a lot of ways, these first-hand experiences drive these traditions. And so you have people experiencing things that just seem absolutely impossible, that are absolutely impossible in our understanding of the world. But nonetheless, that are vivid, at least on an experiential level. And I think that many of the really exotic UFO encounters that we hear about really are part of that kind of spectrum of experience anomaly that you can trace back to religious visionary experience and experience of exotic entities and creatures and so on, and that it's just taking on a different coloration in our time. Now, that doesn't explain the daylight disc that is tracked on instruments and observed visually, or the leaves ground traces, or all these other cases that comprise the hardcore UFO evidence. That maybe probably is something else entirely. That's what I call the event phenomenon. And if you want to argue that this event phenomenon is generated by extraterrestrial visitation, I'm not going to argue with you. I mean, that is a reasonable interpretation. But the more exotic and bizarre and unprovable claims, I think really probably belong in a different ontological category altogether.
And how do we explain those?
We don't explain them. We don't even have a vocabulary.
Yes.
That's one of the problems. It's literally so bizarre that we don't have a vocabulary for it. And, you know, the closest that there is to a vocabulary for it or a word for it is visionary experience. But visionary experience is simply descriptive. It's not explanatory. So we think that something is either true or it isn't true. But what if there are things that happen to us that are neither? Just try to get your brain around that. We don't have a vocabulary. How could something both be and not be at the same time?
Although I'm thinking now of Professor Michio Kaku, who, with his string theory and points that he has brought up in the last couple of 3 years, and to have him suggest that there are, in fact, many other dimensions, and it's a possibility that what we're experiencing here is interdimensional.
Well, again, to me, that doesn't mean a whole lot, at least in terms of what I'm talking about, because
yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any question that experience anomalies have a strong subjective component, that they are experienced in ways that are consistent with a culture's understanding of what an otherworldly encounter would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And that expectation, those traditions change over time, and the experiences change to accommodate them. So it's not like a simple matter of there being some objective other world whose entities and inhabitants we encounter from time to time. There is a strong element of consciousness involved in this. That it's not just a matter of sight, although it's an interesting question what your eyes are seeing when you have one of these experiences, or if your eyes are seeing anything, or if it's just entirely internally generated. But, you know, when you talk about other dimensions, it's like talking about other planets. The implicit assumption is that there are discrete entities that live there, objectively existing. I think that with experience anomalies, we're dealing with something that's really much more complex and has a strong element of subjectivity and consciousness is strongly involved.
You mentioned conspiracies in connection with Jacques Vallée, and there is still much talk about governments and agencies conspiring to keep UFOs and the related phenomena secret. How do you feel about that, Jerry Clark?
Well, I think it's been established that certain kinds of sightings, particularly really sensitive ones that occur over, for example, military installations, are likely to be classified and protected almost like any kind of untoward event that occurred in some kind of sensitive place with national security implications.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I really don't know. I think that the evidence that the U.S. government figured out years and years ago that aliens are visiting us is really not at all conclusive. We have heard a lot of claims allegedly from insiders making all kinds of extraordinary claims about aliens in captivity or communications with aliens or this or that, and these just don't seem to stand up. To the extent that they're investigatable, they fall apart. And we know that there are people in uniform who are, for whatever reason, telling bizarre stories that are just plain lies. So I simply don't know, and I'm skeptical of nearly everything I hear. I would just like to see some good evidence. I read the recent book on Roswell by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, which is a very interesting book, and these guys have put a lot of effort over many years into tracking down every possible informant, and I have enormous respect for what they've done. And to the extent that I keep an open mind about this, it's because of that kind of research. But it's just basically, you know, keep an open mind because ultimately we don't know. But I am personally skeptical of almost everything that I hear, and I would urge other people to be the same. And I don't say that just because I'm rejecting it. I'm just saying that based on a whole lot of experience we've had in the last two or three decades.
Roswell is not a good case as far as you're concerned?
I think Roswell is a genuine mystery. Whatever happened at Roswell has not been satisfactorily accounted for. And I'm glad that there are sober and responsible people who are continuing to investigate this. But when he says Roswell a good UFO case, that may be a separate question.
Mm-hmm.
A good UFO case is a case where you've got enormous documentation. For example, a radar visual case where you've got a whole lot of documents. You've interviewed the witnesses. You've examined all possible counter-explanations. The Roswell investigation is based entirely on anecdotes. And the anecdotes don't even start getting collected until the late 1970s, which is, you know, 30 years after the event.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, it's not a good case because you don't have documents. You weren't interviewing people right after it happened. You're dependent on people's memories long after the fact. And we know that we all have problems with our memories. So often we have a hard time remembering what happened to us yesterday.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that memory is useless, of course. If it were, we literally couldn't survive. But it does cause problems, and we also know that many people who have testified about Roswell, or at least a number of people who have testified about their alleged involvement in Roswell, were not telling the truth. And so it's a sifting process. But it's not a good UFO case because of those problems, but it is a genuine historical mystery, and it will be resolved only when the day comes that the surviving documents, if there are any surviving documents, are made available to us, and they're of unquestioned provenance. We know they're not something like MJ-12 or something dubious like that, but real documents from the officers who were on site, who were there, who were involved in whatever happened.
I think it's interesting that despite the lapse of 30 years before anybody started probing people's memories, there's a lot of overlap of those memories that one can't call coincidence. And a lot of those collected memories were collected before there was any public or common knowledge about Roswell.
Yes, there were people talking about it before anybody thought to interview them and begin to collect testimony and compare it against other people's testimony. Yeah, Roswell doesn't just start as a mystery in the late 1970s. So, you know, there were people talking about it, but it's all, from the investigator's point of view, it's all retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just trying to reconstruct something that happened that even the Air Force admits was covered up at the time, and trying to reconstruct something that was covered up to begin with and then now suffer some vagaries of time and memory and so on. And it is really unresolvable until, say, hardware or documents are recovered. Until then, you could argue it forever.
I thought it puzzling that the base records for that time had disappeared when there are documents from before and after.
Oh, absolutely. This mogul balloon explanation is preposterous on its face. And it may be that there is a non-UFO explanation for what happened in Roswell, but I can practically guarantee you that the investigating officers who went out in the field to recover that wreckage would have instantly recognized the weather balloon. It's just preposterous to argue otherwise.
As people have said many times, especially intelligence officers from the most secret military unit in the American forces.
Well, Errol, you and I would recognize the remains of a weather balloon. It doesn't take an Einstein.
No, I really, really hope that before I go, we find out about a lot of this stuff. Cases that have impressed you a lot over the years that you would stand by and say, yeah, that was a UFO or a flying saucer or something physical and anomalous.
Well, I think that as a category, the best case are the close encounters of the second kind. And those are where there is some kind of physical or instrumented evidence of the presence of some kind of seemingly extraordinary object or craft. It's in that category that the UFO mystery, at least the event UFO mystery, will be solved. That is solvable. I think the reason it hasn't been solved, the reason that UFOs on that level, the event core phenomenon, remains unsolved and controversial and disputed, is that the science hasn't been done. The evidence is there, it's just that the evidence doesn't mean anything if science doesn't do its job. Brad Sparks, who's an aerospace engineer and a very bright researcher into the phenomenon, and also very knowledgeable about the history of UFOs, has pointed out that there's been less than 6 months of actual science done in the entire history of the UFO controversy, which goes back to 1947. You can't solve a scientific mystery without science. And if scientists aren't willing to apply science and the expensive resources of scientific inquiry into a scientific question, nothing happens. You just, with those of us who are amateurs, just simply collect puzzling testimony, and when we can, we collect physical evidence, but if no one will take that physical evidence into a laboratory and do science with it, it doesn't mean anything. Scientists have actually pretty much at the point now where they're using the long neglect of the subject as justification for further neglect. There are individual scientists who are publicly or more often privately and quietly involved, but it's not science as an institution. And science is an institution is what solves big scientific questions, whether, you know, it's AIDS or global warming or whatever question science takes up. It requires money, it requires resources, it requires expertise, it requires laboratories, it requires government involvement often. And obviously that's not happening, and it's not going to happen, and that's why, I mean, it will happen eventually, I'm certain. But I don't think, Errol, that you and I are going to go to our graves knowing the answers. I'm sorry to have to tell you.
Well, as I've said before, then I'm going to come back as a very pissed ghost and go and haunt the people that once I pass, I will know knew about it.
Yeah. Well, I'll join you. We'll have a whole gang of ghosts.
Double hauntings. And we won't tell them who we were. On the UFO updates list, there have been a few old-timers who are apparently really not thrilled with latter-day ufology. Would you count yourself as one of those?
Oh, yes. I'm just one of those grumpy old guys. That's right.
But not as grumpy or as old as some of them.
Well, I think that in terms of age, my old friend Dick Hall is a little older than I am, but we see things pretty much the same. Dick and I have been around since the 50s, and we've seen a lot. And we've also seen any number of blind alleys driven blindly down, and it's very frustrating when you try to caution some young hotshot from not going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street, to quote the title of an old country song, and they call you a debunker or a CIA agent or, yeah, some kind of evil force in the universe. It's very frustrating, and I don't take it well, and neither does Dick.
No. And there seem to be very few investigations of UFO reports in this century. Unless,
I think that's true, yes.
Unless I'm not privy to a lot of those investigations.
I mean, you're talking about field investigations.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that part of it is that there have been field investigations going on from the beginning of ufology in the early 50s. And some cases have been very well investigated and very well documented, and they just get put in some file somewhere and forgotten about. When I was working on my UFO encyclopedia, I did a lot of my work in the considerable and impressive archives of the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. And I was just amazed. The center archives include the files of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, or NICAP, which was the major serious UFO organization of the late 50s and 60s. And NICAP had this whole network of field investigators. And these field investigators would go out and investigate reports, whether they were just anything from nocturnal lights to contactee stories and everything in between. And they just did a fabulous job. And they would come back with these fat folders based on their interviews and investigations of the site and study of weather records and flight paths and investigation of all kinds of alternative prosaic explanations. They just do a textbook job. They were doing a much better job than the Air Force investigators were doing, because I would also have access to the Air Force files, which were pathetic, next to the NICAP files. I wrote a lot of my book around some of those cases from the 60s out of the NICAP files, and this stuff had really never seen print before, and it just sat there. I mean, there have been abbreviated accounts in the literature, but not full accounts that gave you some sense of just how comprehensive a job these conscientious civilian investigators were doing. There are people outside NICAP who did good jobs, too, for the various UFO organizations or individually, and nothing came of it. And I think that a certain kind of morale failure has set in the 21st century. Sort of feeling of, why bother? This isn't going to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
We're still going to be called nuts. Nobody's going to pay attention to what I found, and here we are.
There are actually online a couple of substantial databases now.
Mm-hmm.
I think NICAP is one of them.
Right.
Francis Ridge and several people have been very much involved with that.
There are very good people out there. There always have been very good people out there. And when I talk like this, I don't mean to disparage the good, decent, hard-working, smart people who are still out there.
Understood. One of the previous times you were on this program, there was a lot of concern for the well-being of the Center for UFO Studies. Is that concern still abounding, or have things settled a bit for QFOS?
Well, I was watching Bill Clinton on David Letterman last night, and Bill Clinton said that one thing he was not going to do on the David Letterman show was make news. So I just don't think I should make news.
There's a very political answer.
I just say that inevitably, with the passage of time, things change.
Good. And I trust for the better. There. Good silence. So other than your UFO research and authorship over the years, you have tended toward what a lot of people call, after Charles Fort, Fortean phenomena. Are you still involved in putting together books about the strange things that go on around us other than UFOs?
Well, after I'd spent, you know, virtually all of the 1990s working on the UFO Encyclopedia, which just turned into five fat volumes, I really got burned out. And I just kind of had to catch my breath and try to figure out where, if anywhere, I wanted to go. And eventually I realized that what I was really interested in was anomalies and proto-UFO phenomena from before 1947, and particularly in the 19th century. This happily coincided with the emergence of the internet era, and I learned that you could subscribe to newspaper archives online, so you didn't have to drive a million miles to go through some dusty archive and spend weeks unearthing a treasure here and there, but you could do it online. So I've been doing it now for the last several years. That's what I do most of my work day, is go through old newspapers and collect accounts of a range of bizarre phenomena, including UFO-like reports, cryptozoological creatures, ghosts, falls in the sky, the kinds of things that Charles Fort was finding when he was doing his research in the 19-teens and 1920s. And it kind of takes me in this big sort of unbroken circle back to where I came from, which was the second book that I read after Rupel was Charles Fort's book. And so I'm back really to where I'm starting from, and I'm picking up where Fort left off and just having a really great time. And my book, Unnatural Phenomena, is about these early Fortean cases I found. I found hundreds and hundreds since. I find them daily. And after I get off the phone to you, I'm going to go back to doing that. That's what I do most of my day, and I'm writing another book on the subject.
Do you find that there's a connection, however slim, between UFOs and Fortean phenomena?
How do I answer that? Charles Fort was the first ufologist. He was the first guy not just to understand that people saw strange things in the sky, but that this was a phenomenon that was being reported all over the world over time and space. So in his investigation of mysteries of the physical world, Fort wasn't much interested in psychic phenomena, but he was interested in ostensible physical mysteries. He discovered UFOs. Of course, he didn't call them that, but that's what they were. He wrote four books, but it's only the first three that discuss UFO-like phenomena. But he was also discovering all this other stuff, like frogs falling out of the sky and weird creatures encountered on the ground or in the lakes or the seas and so on. And so he's all these weird stories. And Fort developed this kind of overarching theory where he tried to put it all together in some kind of theory of interplanetary visitation. You know, basically he seemed to believe that Martians were coming to Earth, they were contacting humans, and they were also responsible for a broad range of phenomena, monsters, falls and so on. Well, I don't think this is true. There's certainly nobody coming from Mars, and I don't think there's a connection between UFOs and falls in the sky. But they're interesting because they're event phenomena. Frogs and other animals and inorganic materials do indeed fall from the sky. There doesn't seem to be any satisfactory conventional explanation. And I don't think that UFOs are related to sightings of, say, sea serpents. But these things seem both to be genuinely anomalous and to raise many of the same kinds of scientific and intellectual and experiential questions. And so you can learn to think about UFOs by studying parallel phenomenal claims. And you find out that ufologists and cryptozoologists and also parapsychologists really confront the same kinds of questions, the same kinds of scientific dilemmas and the problems of being accepted as legitimate areas of inquiry and so on. And of course, these things are just intrinsically interesting.
And have always fascinated me, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who listen to this program and who subscribe to the updates email list that also are fascinated by other phenomena.
Well, this is a very interesting world, and it's a very complicated one. And I think these puzzles should intrigue us. They should keep our brains and our intellects alive, and we should just be open to all kinds of interesting possibilities. Science isn't that old. We began looking at the world and scientifically only relatively recently, a few hundred years ago, and modern science really starts probably in the 19th century. Let's keep our mind open to what science a century or a thousand years or 10,000 years from now will look like, what it will deal with, how it will see the world and the universe.
And I think on that note, Jerome Clark, it's a good point to wrap this up.
Well, thank you for having me, Errol. It is great fun, and thank you for hearing me out.
I wanted to make sure that Jerome Clark is out there in people's personal recordings more so than when I did the radio program, because that comes and goes and it's gone into the ether. But as a podcast, your voice and this time will live on doubtlessly far into the future. So there.
I'm speechless.
And for the listener, if you go to Amazon.com and type in the search criteria, authors Jerome Clark, and that's without an E, C-L-A-R-K, and of course Jerome has an E in it, or two, Google or Amazon.com, and all of the books that we have talked about, probably plus a bunch of others, will pop for you. I look forward to talking to you again, and with any luck, the next time we talk, something will have popped that we can go, see, we were right all along.
Let's hope so.
Not holding my breath, though.
No.
No. Bye, Jerome Clark.
Take care. Bye.
I'm Pat Bush, and I was married to George Bush, the brother of Miriam. Her name was Miriam Titus when I knew her. She worked at the base hospital. She was an executive secretary there, had a high security rating. The head of the hospital there came to her one afternoon and said, "I think there's something you would like to see." And he took her down to the surgical suite or whatever it was in the hospital where they had brought these beings. They took her into the room and she saw them. They wouldn't let her get close to them, but she stood by the doorway and looked at them. As she was looking at them, one of them moved its middle finger on its hand. The hand moved. So whatever it was living at that time. She went home that evening. And she was excited about what she had seen, and she sat at the dinner table and told the family what she had seen and what they had told her had happened. And they were all interested and asked questions. And the next day when she came in from work, she was very somber, and she just told them, "Don't ever mention what I told you. And don't ever ask me anything about it." And she was very frightened. I felt very sorry for her because she lived a very frightened life because they had told her not to ever speak of it again and what the consequences would be. And she was frightened her whole life long about it. She passed away in this unusual way, and we started kind of looking at things and talking to people and realizing that many of the other people that were involved in it had died mysterious deaths or disappearances. She was in a motel, and she was not registered at the motel under her name. She had registered under her sister's name, which is very strange, and her sister didn't know she was there. The authorities came in because it was the sister's name and address on the registration. They called her home, and then she knew that her sister had passed away. When the police came and everything, they said that it had to be a suicide, that the door was locked from inside. Nobody could lock the door from the inside. It just skimmed over the top of it. You know, they didn't go into any research, try to find out anything about her. I just don't believe that she killed herself. I think somebody else did it. There was something that was being covered up, and evidently something important enough that they would kill to keep it a secret.
And that wraps up edition 448 of Strange Days Indeed. My thanks to Dave Ferlot, Smiles Lewis, and Jerome Clark, and also to the Sci-Fi Channel for the Roswell voices. And of course, my thanks to you for being out there. Until next time.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.